Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
I was born a poor black boy in Mississippi. Not really. Actually, I'm from Northern Michigan, but I felt just as out of place when I moved to New York City and had my first job with Patrick Martins, my boss at Heritage Foods USA. And that was the start of a long journey in food here in the New York State area. And I'm forever thankful for his leadership and his guidance, and really appreciate working with him as part of the team here at Heritage Radio Network, and want to wish him a very happy birthday.
This is Jack Inslee, and I can't say enough about what Patrick has done for me personally and the leadership he's shown to everybody that works for him, and I especially want to congratulate him on his program, The Main Course, which now I can legitimately say is one of our top 30 shows. So congratulations, Patrick.
We'll encourage him to stay tuned for a very special happy birthday song, sung by myself, Joe Galarraga, and Jack Inslee. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Patrick. Happy birthday to you. And many more.
Wow, that was really nice. That is really nice. Thanks for playing that, Joe. Joe, are you there?
Oh, I'm here. And I got the clap.
The clapping. Yeah, thanks for using the sound effects. Well, what an amazing beginning to The Main Course. I'm your host, Patrick Martins. We're broadcasting live on February 10th out of Roberta's Restaurant, 261 Moore Street. Want to thank our sponsors at Whole Foods for their most generous sponsorship. That was really sweet, Joe. Thanks so much. Aaron's like, he's my boss at Heritage Foods USA. I'm like, what about the radio network?
True. Got to shout out the radio network.
Although on the radio network, I'm just a board member. So I guess I have to, you know, to make any real decision, I have to line up my ducks. But that was really, really sweet. And Joe, you have a very deep voice.
That's modern technology helping out a little
bit. Oh, I see. I was like, that's got Barbershop Quartet written all over it. Well, you know, the cycle of the seasons, Joe, as you were saying to me earlier, finds us in the cold grip of winter. A time when hardly anything on the farm grows. Folks stay at home more. Calorie-laden meals and even a touch of gluttony are tolerated. So I bring up gluttony because two of our guests have been on a glutton rage with us. We went to Corsino, to Maialino, to Momo Sushi Shack, to Roberta's, and we have been, you know, people pull out all the stops for you guys because our guests later are going to be Mario and Teresa, the owners of Paradise Locker Meats, one of the most consistent and reputable and well-respected processing plants and slaughterhouses in the country. They never mess up. They keep all the breeds traceable to the farm and label everything individually. It is no easy task. But then also about to come on, Evan Hanscore, the chef of Parish Hall, and his colleague, George Weld, who is the founder of Egg Goatfell Farm and Parish Hall. So we're really excited to have him on. But I do want to kind of bring up gluttony just before we start. Rabelais, for all of you guys who are not 400 years old, Rabelais wrote about gluttony. And his main character in these kind of comic reels, comic thing strips that he would do, was Gargantua. And it was really funny when he would write about Gargantua because he was always super precise about exactly how gluttonous this giant party animal was. And he would be like, Gargantua consumed 231 vats of wine, which in turn produced 1,108 gallons of urine, which he, you know, peed into the rivers, causing a flood, which, you know, fertilized the fields. And it was hilarious. So, you know, it's my birthday, and we live in a very puritanical society that's always feeling guilt about consumption. We shouldn't consume. We shouldn't go out. We shouldn't drink a lot. You know, consumption is bad. It seems to take. Whereas in Europe, it's the opposite. You know, consumption is a beautiful thing, and you should really go all out every now and then. So I recommended this last week, and since today's my birthday, I recommend it again that people, for instance, go to Parish Hall. If they like the octopus appetizer, they should order 10 of them. Just a mountain of it. And you know, it would cost $200 probably, but it would be probably the most enjoyable experience for someone who loves octopus. So let yourself go. Fall into gluttony every once in a while. And I actually think the best way of dieting is to be a glutton, controlled glutton. So whether you go out all out once a month or twice a month, you know, eat more sometimes to eat less. But all right, well, after that mediocre interview, I'm still, God, I can never do these opening things very well. But I want to bring in our guests. It's a real honor to have both of them in, Evan Hanscore and George Weld. Welcome.
Hi, thanks. Hey.
So, George, you founded Egg in 2005, Goat Fell Farm in 2007, and Parish Hall in 2012.
Yeah.
That's an interesting order. Just take us through how you're from the South, you came to Brooklyn, and then you opened these three things. Just give us the headlines of how that happened.
So in 2005, I think I grew up kind of in the South, surrounded by farms and farmers, and always sort of hoped that I would end up doing that, and moved to Brooklyn where it seemed like a distant possibility. And had talked to some friends of mine who had a restaurant in this neighborhood about possibly one day growing stuff to supply them and living upstate in some kind of bucolic hut. And after a year or so of me going on about this, they said, well, actually, we'd love it if you would start a restaurant in our restaurant to sort of try that out for a while. And I leapt at the chance and started Egg in the... in the walls of another restaurant, and we just opened at 7 in the morning and stayed open till noon and then closed down and let them come in and do their thing.
Very interesting, a restaurant based off breakfast. That's yeah. So almost anti-Williamsburg. I mean, unless it was exactly, like people yeah, yeah. who had not gone to sleep from yeah. the night before, that would make sense.
We got a few of them, and there's definitely a lot of, like, I would see in the mornings, I would wake up and walk down my street, still had some meat processors on it, so they would be loading up their trucks as they were getting ready to go do their deliveries, and then I would also step over the, you know, passed out bodies of new NYU students who were just learning how to mm-hmm. live away from home, and had spent the night sleeping on their skateboards on Wythe Avenue. But yeah, so we were it was something I sort of figured would last for a year or two, and then I would go on and do something else, get a job in someone else's restaurant, or try to get this farm started. But Egg worked out. It turned out there were enough people who wanted to get up at that hour in Williamsburg to keep us busy. And after a couple of years, the people who owned the restaurant that I had started in wanted to move out of the neighborhood, move their business out of the neighborhood, so they let me buy them out. And at the same time, my wife had been talking about spending some time away from the city, and we started looking around for a farm. So it all kind of happened in one big lump of commitment, I guess.
Well, I loved Egg. The first time I ever went to Egg was Ben Flanner, the owner uh-huh. and founder of Brooklyn Grange. It took a farmer to get me up that early yeah. at 8 a.m., and it was luxurious. We're going to talk about this later, but Mario and Teresa are in studio. 12 bacon slabs a week. You know, you see that order every Tuesday afternoon. Well, that is your Phantasma's Finest bacon, you know, feeding the hipsters in Williamsburg. Hipsters and other awesome. People, you know, in Williamsburg. So
yeah.
Who would have thought the reach of Mario Fantasma's paws would be all the way in the heart of Bushwick and Williamsburg. We also have in studio with us Evan Hanscore, who graduated from Tulane in 2008. in creative writing and philosophy. Is that right?
Yeah.
It's interesting. Then you're from Connecticut, and you worked at The Dressing Room, which was, I think, with Michelle Nashan, right?
That's where we first met.
Newman started that restaurant right adjacent to a theater.
That's right.
Yeah. What's the name of that theater?
The Westward Playhouse, or the Country Playhouse.
Right, it's like a community kind of center with a delicious restaurant, so that's a great place to have worked. And then you came to New York and started at Egg, huh?
Yeah, I found my way over to Egg. I had a short stint working in the city at a place called La Conda Verde. That just wasn't exactly what I was looking for at the time. And
Andrew Carmelini,
that's
right?
That's right. Amazing restaurant. I think a little overwhelming for someone coming from Connecticut, for coming into the city. And then I made my way to Egg, which was seemed to be much more my style. And a lot of the values that I started to pick up at working at The Dressing Room with Michelle, who's been kind of the head of all the things we consider important in the food movement for years and years. I found kind of being thought about and acted upon in a pretty exciting way. I thought the way George was doing it at Egg. So I think it clicked, where I was coming from and what they were doing.
So besides the mission, what were the dishes you were making that kind of turned you on? Because, it is a kind of breakfast-inspired menu anyway.
Yeah.
So did you find that interesting, how to perfect cooking of an egg and all these kind of, simple, time-honored techniques?
Yeah, at that point, I was still extremely young in my cooking career. I'd only been cooking for about a year and a half when I started at Egg. Learning how to cook eggs properly was something that I pretty much skipped over, aside from what I would do at home. I think the idea of paying close care and attention to something so simple, and a number of things so simple that were at the same time deeply rooted in tradition and had a significant place in everyone's everyday life was pretty appealing to me.
It's interesting how we've lost touch with the kind of apprenticing. You make the same thing 10,000 times.
Right. Yeah.
Are there still components or aspects of cooking an egg that you feel you could do better or that you're not always the same with every time?
Yeah, I think with everything, the goal is to achieve that highest level of performance, and you don't always achieve that.
What's missing in the egg? Too long cooked, too watery, too runny? How do you define the grammar of when it's not perfect versus when it is?
Well, it would take years to define that, but I think for the most part, what I see is people cook eggs a little bit too hot and too long, so they end up a little bit drier than you would like them. And once you've had that perfectly cooked egg, you kind of understand, wow, this is what I've been shooting for, and kind of overshooting a little bit.
Interesting. So then you two opened Parish Hall together, right? You decided to open it. Take us through the challenges and a little bit of the timeline of opening a restaurant in Brooklyn.
Well, yeah. It was kind of an amazing coincidence. I think when Evan started at Egg, he was still feeling out whether he wanted to stay in this business. I think, as he mentioned, he has a creative writing background, which I also have. So we would sort of talk about writing on the one hand and then cooking on the other, and I wasn't sure we were going to be able to keep him in the kitchen, which is where I wanted him. And at the same time, I'd started looking around for a way to grow our business, and was looking around with our old operations manager, Holly Howard, who now is running her own consulting company. But at the time, was like sort of knocking around the neighborhood, thinking up ideas with us, and we stumbled across this spot, and we liked the space and seemed like it would give us all the opportunities that the really narrow space at Egg never did. And I kept thinking, well, as long as I can keep Evan from leaving, this is going to work out just great. And so sort of like got to the point with the development of Parish Hall, signing a lease or thinking through a business model and a business plan and trying to understand what we thought the neighborhood would need.
What is the business plan for a restaurant? It's just the menu, right? And then carrying it out correctly, how many people do you need? The menu must be a big part of it.
The menu's a big part of it, but the menu's a big part of it. A lot of it has to do with sort of understanding, how you, when we were thinking about Parish Hall, we were thinking that the neighborhood could use several different kinds of restaurants. It could be another you know, we could always have opened a bigger egg. We could open, I mean, at the time, especially there wasn't a whole lot going on there. So sort of like looking at different things that you could stay interested in for a long time. And sort of saying, well, if we put these kinds of dishes together at a menu, or we put a restaurant together like this, who would go there? What kind of people would it serve? Are they the right kind of people? Like, are there enough of them? Do we want to serve those people? And trying to bring all the pieces together into one thing. The menu's a big part of it, but there's a lot else to it. Finding the right people is a big part of it. And then, you know, having great suppliers and knowing that you can count on, you know, that you're putting together food that you can source from people you trust.
I think for us, you know, the menu is a big part of it, but was kind of maybe the least challenging part of it. Like, we knew, like, when you cook, you know, you had experience cooking and working in a restaurant as busy as egg and making food consistently, you know that you can make food that tastes good, that people are going to like, and do it consistently. And I think the thing for us, as George is, you know, saying, is figuring out our place in the neighborhood and also, like, our vision, like, what's our perspective on, like, what are we going to offer that's something either new or a little bit underexplored or really important to us and closely connected to us. And I think in the end, when we decided we weren't going to do, like, another sort of egg, you know, that's going to distinguish it from this place that's become such a staple of the neighborhood.
But, I mean, it doesn't necessarily translate. I mean, a different restaurant won't necessarily be successful because one model works. So where did you stay the same, and where did you stay, you know, how far did you push yourself, and how do you define Parish Hall's menu?
I mean, I think at the deepest levels, the kind of things that keep us working and excited about the work we do every day, all those things stayed the same. You know, the idea of working with producers who we really admire and trust, trying to provide a place where the people who work with us can feel they're constantly challenged and improving every day, a place that we can feel we're challenged every day to develop in new ways. You know, having a similar aesthetic in the way we treat the food, you know, with respect and some sort of simplicity, but at the same time, at Parish Hall, we wanted to branch out a little bit and give our cooks a little bit more room to play and to develop and to challenge themselves.
So what's one a dish that you would never see at Egg, but that you do there? I mean, is it French technique, American technique? Is it dressing room inspired?
I think we definitely use French technique and American technique, and the way we came to talk about Parish Hall, which actually only kind of came together fully in the maybe hours or a day before our first all staff meeting before we opened, was to ask ourselves, you know, we cook in this area in the Northeast, and we have this restaurant Egg that's Southern and works in a tradition that's very well defined and deep and old and delicious and identifiable. And then with Parish Hall, you know, I was thinking about growing up in this region in Connecticut, in the Hudson River Valley, and George and I had lots of conversations about it and threw around all sorts of somewhat crazy ideas, and ended up coming to asking ourselves, what is Northeastern cuisine? You know, if you can define Southern cuisine so fully and richly, why isn't that established for the Northeast? Is it something about the food culture here? Is it something about, you know, the South being more bountiful? And I thought all the answers to those sorts of questions were no. Like, there's nothing preventing it from being as rich and as exciting as Southern food. And so we should challenge ourselves to kind of figure out where the food of this region comes from, what traditions it involves, and where it should be, and when, where it could go, you know, in all sorts of different ways. So that's the kind of the question we try to answer every day at Parish Hall.
So does that limit you? I also wanted to ask the farm. I mean, how does that relationship work? Because I suppose sometimes you need the restaurant to take certain things, but you're also growing with the restaurant in mind. So how does that work?
I mean, everything at the farm goes to the restaurant, so that we, so we don't 100%. Have any other market yet. So we've had three.
Talk closer to the mic.
Oh. We've had probably three really consistent, like, strong seasons with the farm and the restaurant. And the way we've worked between the restaurants and the farm has changed every year. Once, you know, when we were just supplying egg, there were only so many vegetables we could squeeze into that menu. We used to serve dinner at egg, so we would try to get more in there. At Parish Hall, it's much more like of a back and forth. And I think this year will be the best model for it, where we just sat down and went through our seed order this month, and like, do we want to grow this? Well, we know that we know that these things don't grow that well up there, that we're not that good at growing them. We know that we can grow these really well, but you know, maybe Evan doesn't want to use them as much. We're like kind of tired of seeing them. So
he's like, "Do not send me another friggin' fiddlehead, or I will kill you." One the, more.
What came up
ramp.
The other day was a red vein sorrel. It's like, we've had enough red vein sorrel baby leaves. They were pretty for a while. But.
I took a trip with Carlo Petrini, the founder of Soul Food, down from Vermont all the way, and it was fiddlehead season. And every single event, they were like, "Carlo, something," and he would use some horrible Piedmontese dialect filled with curses. He's like, "Motherfucker, fiddleheads." They're like, "Carlo doesn't look happy." Like, this is the 80th meal in a row that fiddleheads has been the center.
I mean, that's one of the challenging things at Parish Hall and with having a farm, is that just the fact of the matter is we're going to get more as a zucchini than we can use for a couple months, and we're going to get an insane amount of tomatoes for a couple months, and now the only things we have in our vegetable walk-in are parsnips, rutabaga, celery root, carrots, kale, onions. Like, it's very limited now. So how do you make those things interesting? How do you not get this kind of like effect of, God, I can't eat another, you know, yeah. I can't even say this now because it's the middle of winter, but like, I can't even eat another tomato. And right now, all I want is a tomato. You know,
it sounds like you cook in the Italian style then. I mean, all the chefs that have come through this station, I so often hear that's Italian in a way. Just cook with what's there.
Yeah, it's kind of, I mean, it's not even just Italian. It's kind of just traditional in general. You know,
every
you look
cuisine
back,
almost.
Every culture has cooked like that for a long time. And then, of course, things change. And I'm not saying that the only way to cook is to use local food. Mm-hmm. I think it fits for us at Parish Hall because if we're, you know, claiming to try to explore the cuisine of this region, it only makes sense to focus on the ingredients that come from here.
So let's move on to the protein part of the meal. And I'm just going to play devil's advocate here. Nose to tail. That, you know, I constantly see it written about, like in the New York Times food section, or, you know, there'll be a picture of a butcher with a cigarette coming out of his mouth and a whole pig on the cover of Food and Wine and Bon Appetit. And I just don't think that many chefs do it. I think that it's not, shouldn't even necessarily, I mean, of course you want to, you know, engage people in the art of butchery, but, you know, they're butchers and, you know, you leave it to the experts and you shouldn't be limited to have to use a whole pig. Bring in 100 Boston butts, and it's the farmer's job to figure out a way to still get local quality, sustainable quality. So why do it? Is it as big a thing? So I ask you guys this because you are hardcore and you bring in a half pig or a whole pig every single week. So, you know, describe that challenge because you're really affecting the menu when you have to use a little bit of everything.
Yeah, I mean, we change our menu, I'd say at least, you know, 4 times a week just because of the different cuts of meats we're going through and the different vegetables we're going through.
Why do you do that?
It's actually a question I've been asking myself a lot recently. you know, we've been getting in sides of beef now and breaking those down.
God, what's that, 300-400 pounds?
300-400 pounds, yeah. And, you know, the pigs are not tiny either, and we do whole lambs, and of course we do poultry and fish. And, you know, when we started doing it, it's basically, the goal was education. It's like, there's something... I knew there was something that we would get to, some sort of a deeper understanding of the product we're using if we started from the beginning and took things apart and figured out where they came from. And it is true, you know. I don't think that's just like a fantasy. You know, when I'm even in the past week, you know, breaking down beef, where all the muscle structure is much larger, and the individual muscles that might be kind of cast aside or lumped in with something else on a pig or a lamb are so much more well defined.
It's the biggest livestock species there is, so everything's bigger.
So after butchering those and like taking skirt steaks off, and I go back to breaking down a pig, and I see the belly where I might have just normally cut it off and cured the whole thing for bacon. It's like, I can take a couple of these things off and turn them into something, a sandwich or a steak, and it has its own unique characteristic and quality. And that's pretty amazing. And it's amazing to teach that that skill and that sense of understanding and kind of curiosity to the cooks who work with you, even if they're not going to go on to do that sort of thing in their own restaurants. Do I think it's essential, you know, to be a sustainable restaurant to do nose to tail? No, I don't think so. I think it's something that we choose to do at Parish Hall for ourselves, and because it does offer some exciting possibilities to customers. But
does it help your food costs, hurt it, or have no effect?
I think in the end it probably doesn't have much of an effect because your labor costs end up being higher. You spend time, you know, breaking those things down.
Of course, the per pound price is cheaper, so you can get a tenderloin for a third the price, but that's just 1 pound of the animal.
And then you have many pounds of bones to use and many pounds of trim to use. It forces you to be creative in a lot of ways, which is one of the things that, you know, even limiting ourselves to, you know, using root vegetables in the winter forces us to be creative. So in the same way that it's limiting is that, you know, we're not going to have short rib on the menu every night. We're not going to have ribeye on the menu every night. That limits what we're able to offer. It also kind of expands what we're able to do and I think how creative we're forced to be.
Well, the first thing I was going to say is there was definitely a point at Egg when we were using half pigs when we could easily get rid of all the cheap cuts, you know, the shoulder and the belly and stuff, but we couldn't sell enough pork chops to balance out the cost of it. So that and at Egg, it could become a really it got to be really hard, which is where it was helpful to have people like you guys in you know providing us with you know the cuts that we needed. One thing that I was maybe wondering if we could ask you though mm-hmm. I know that one of the reasons that a lot of people get interested in Nose to Tail is the idea that, yeah, so there's only like one flank steak on a cow, or there's very limited, and the idea that like so if you're serving flank steak, all the rest of that cow is just going in the garbage somewhere, which I know can't possibly be true, like where the efficiency comes in on the processor's end that guarantees. I mean, there are definitely animals that we couldn't get unless we bought whole. I mean, we buy lambs from a friend upstate. We buy pigs from friends upstate. They don't have the capacity. We couldn't afford it if they butchered it to use those things. And we like being able to use them. But when it comes to things like getting, you know, more cuts of we go through more bacon and egg than we go through pigs. You know,
How does it work?
Yeah, I feel like there's a lot of myth around the idea that like if you're not doing it. You're consigning the rest of this animal to some horrible fate.
And well, no, I mean, you
obviously that's not the case.
As an example, Mario, take us to the bottom of the barrel cuts that we don't even use, and then those steps up, like the ones that people think fat, bones, trim, hair, skin. What's all happening to that?
You know, it's amazing. I think a lot of people are using skin on cuts. You know, they like that. The way it cooks, you know, that skin holds the moisture and all the juice inside the meat as it's being cooked. So that's one way of looking at it and using something that may be pitched or thrown.
But what do? You have people come pick up. You have a truck back into your locker and you load it. Where does that stuff go?
That
and what
stuff
cuts
goes
is
to,
that?
Well, that would be any excess bones, fat that is not being sold, and even some skin as well. And that goes to a rendering company, and they break it down and actually, it all gets used in some shape or form.
Yeah.
Make it into soap or oils or whatever.
Pet food,
pet food,
right?
Yes, it
but
all
most
goes into
of it.
Yeah, the whole soap. Industry must work. You know, it's based on like efficiency and using every last bit of it.
That's right.
You know.
We're about to take a break here, and then we're going to hear an ad and hear about one of the successful shows on the network. Let me just ask you a real interesting question that you brought up. How much is value added? What part of the pig and what part of the cow do you have to do something to?
Like at the restaurant.
Yeah, make a sausage out of it or value added. Because Mario was just telling me and Teresa that she's the money lady at Paradise Soccer Meats. Value added is the secret. Killing pigs, that's not going to make you money. It's they get trimmed. They have their own sausage line. That's where. So what are you doing? I asked both of you or whoever's working with the whole animal. What percentage do you have to be like, we got to dry age this?
Or, yeah, I mean, pretty much everything except for the prime cuts and the pig. We use the loin, the full loin. We actually turn it into a whole boneless loin and use it on a pork plate with multiple ways. But every other cut on that plate is either like a piece of shoulder that's been braised or a piece of sausage we've made or a torchon from the head meat. So everything except for something that you can just cut off, either brine and or season and cook, you're doing something to and you're putting labor into and putting a lot of thought into.
So value added ends up being really important. Well, we're going to take a very short break and we're going to bring Mario and Teresa into the picture and continue this discussion on proteins and restaurants.
You're listening to Spreadin' Honey by the California Honey Drops on the heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Are you a locavore? Our Northeast regional forager for Whole Foods Market sure is. She spends her time traveling around the New York City metro area sourcing the best new or interesting artisanal and handcrafted local products for our purchasing teams at the local store level. Part of our commitment to our local suppliers includes assisting them with the process of getting their products sold at our stores. Whether it's suggesting packaging designs, pricing, or distribution methods, she's helping some of the area's best new products reach savvy shoppers at Whole Foods Market stores. Today, New York. Tomorrow, the world. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
You're lazy, but you just might find it's them that's crazy.
Red,
just raising them rats, I'm making dough get fat, hanging up their hat. No, we ain't living like that.
Spreading,
so tell your mama you've been spreading honey, won't you? Tell your brother you've been spreading honey, won't you? Tell your sister you've been spreading honey, won't they? Come along and spread some honey too. Oh, won't they come along and spread some honey too.
Every Tuesday at 12 p.m., you can call food scientist Dave Arnold and ask any question you want.
John from Chicago, you're on the air.
Hey, Dave.
Cooking issues!
Who am I fooling? This is horrible stuff. Without glutamic acid, you die.
It is a matter of taste, but there's a lot more fat in sausage than you think.
Get ahead of the curve. Tune into Cooking Issues every Tuesday at 12 p.m. on heritageradionetwork.org.
Mario Fantasma did not like hearing that there is more fat in sausage than you'd like to think. He made an angry face.
That's good fat.
That's the check is in the mail face. Oh, brother. Well, very interesting. We are broadcasting live. We're sponsored by Whole Foods Market. We really thank them for sponsoring us. We have Evan Hanscore and George Weld from the Egg Goatfell Farm and Parish Hall Empire. We also have in from Kansas City for my birthday and to see little baby Max, my new son. They 4 weeks or 8 weeks, they wanted to come see him. We have Mario Fantasma and Teresa Fantasma. Welcome, guys.
Hey.
Thank you.
Yeah, we're really psyched for you to come. You guys are like family at this point. I, you know, came there like a little northern carpetbagger in 2004 with a little box of my supplies. I was like, can we solder 10 pigs here and cut them into quarters and FedEx them to people around the country? You were like, we don't like this kid. That was a feeling you kept for about 9 years, but now we've started to get into love. You know, we
do it takes 10 years, you know, to, yeah, it takes 10 years to get that feeling of love.
I will say this about you guys, because I've never said this before. I mean, the word heritage is heritage food, or heritage pig, is almost, you know, a foodie term. I mean, that's a household term. No one's like, well, what the hell do you mean by heritage? People understand. It's like the heirloom of the protein world. That's, you know, 50-60% of that came through your little tiny USDA plant in Trimble, Missouri. So, you know, this is, you could liken them to the Chez Panisse of the meat world, maybe. You know, what she did for organic in the 70s is kind of what you did for meats. So I've got to ask you this question, because everyone is constantly lamenting on this radio network across the 30 shows. Lack of slaughterhouses is the biggest bottleneck in the protein industry. Farmers can't start because there's not enough slaughterhouses. There's not enough competition, and on and on and on. Why the hell is it so hard? And is it? I know it's hard work, but is it that insurmountable thing that is the reason that, like, not a single rich investor in the country ever opens a slaughterhouse anywhere? I mean, why is that? What's so hard?
Well, that's a good question. I think, you know, the difficulty of operating a business like a slaughterhouse, especially small, you know, either go big or you stay small, there's really no in between, because you just can't make the profits, that to facilitate the business. So, you know, basically what we're doing is going into these niche markets where we can slaughter heritage breeds, you know, and the demand is growing for them. For the reason why there's not so many slaughterhouses anymore, I mean, a lot of these small slaughterhouses were family owned, and it's either, you know, the kids don't want to take over the business, they don't want to work that hard, you know, so the plant ends up shutting down. There's not enough interest out there for people to run a slaughterhouse. You know, it's probably just the just not having the experience, you know, and the knowledge of the breakdown of animals and how to do it properly. It's kind of a scary step. It was for me when I bought my slaughterhouse. Mm-hmm. But I knew that that's what I wanted to do, because I worked as a butcher in a company in Kansas City cutting steaks and assorted items, boning and doing all kinds of different things. But I knew that that wasn't my future, that I wanted to have my own business. So I think it's that entrepreneur spirit that leads you into doing those things that you love to do. And maybe there's just not enough people that are willing to do it.
Well, Teresa, what's your answer to that question? Because while he's the face of the organization and bringing in the animals and doing the business outside, you're kind of back of the house a little bit, right?
Right. And I would say 10 years ago when HACCP regulation became into effect, that scared so many custom plants that, for one, didn't have the investment money to make their facilities USDA qualified or state qualified, and the regulations that, you know, have even become more and more have just scared the heck out of a lot of people. We have someone working for us that, you know, ran one of those little custom shops when all that took place. Yes. And for, you know, he was like, there's no way I can, you know, meet those demands or whatever.
What's a demand? Describe. Just painstakingly covering every temperature and detail about an entire process?
Yes, but it's also just, you know, what they expect for, you know, record keeping. It's now, you know, what they expect when you try to do all these value added things. You just have, you know, 10 more regulations for this one product. And, you know, the labeling has become important, which I think it should be important to the public, and, you know, so that they know, you know, it's a safe product. But just, you know, there's so many minute little things that have to be added into that it's extremely hard to have people in place that have the education to develop those plans and know how to, you know, work around compliance with them. You know, I mean, it's just, and for those guys that all had, you know, those old things that, you know, didn't run computers and things like that, you know, when all that took place, I think that was the downfall of a lot of, you know, small plants, that they were just like, there's no way I can do that. And when we had our old custom plant that was just you know, not even state inspected, we knew that we would have to get to that point if we were going to move our business forward. Yeah. You had to get USDA. But in our facility that we were in before, there's no way we could have done it. There's no way we could have made it compliant.
What's your guys' experience in upstate New York and then the local scene? What is the slaughterhouse situation? I mean, you guys have a lot of experience working with local purveyors.
So. Well, I was going to say, just with the, you know, regulations and certifications, when you said the word HACCP, I had like a shudder go through my body. We essentially abandoned like a plan to cook meats, like a sous vide, a low temperature cooking, because of what I'm sure is like a fraction of what slaughterhouses have to go through in order to get certified. So I can imagine that being like a pretty big obstacle for people.
Yeah. I know that lately I've stopped hearing people complain about the lack of slaughterhouses in New York, say that finally we're getting slaughterhouses, but now the problems are shifting to other things. For years that was always the issue. Like, we can raise all the animals we want, but it's impossible to get them into a house. And we thought about raising pigs a couple of years ago ourselves, and I called a friend of mine in probably April and said, yeah, I was thinking about getting some feeder pigs for the summer. This guy wants to have a wedding and wants to slaughter his pigs, blah, blah, blah. Well, she was like, if you haven't booked your spot in the slaughterhouse in October already, you're not going to get one.
Wow.
So it was definitely a intense bottleneck. And what it seemed to me is that you had to be at a certain scale in order for it to work. You couldn't do it on a small scale. If you could say, like, I'm bringing in 400 animals in a week and I want them all slaughtered, like, it wouldn't be so hard to find a spot to do it. But if you wanted to do four, you were out of luck.
Your competition like? In upstate New York, I'm like, oh, that slaughterhouse isn't going to do a good job, or it might, but it has no competition, so he'll do whatever the hell he wants up there, because you have to go to him. What's the terrain like in Kansas City area? You know, used to be the epicenter of the meat industry for the country.
You know, as far as small slaughterhouses are concerned, I don't really consider competition out there. Everybody has their local markets that they work for, their farmers they work for. Obviously, it doesn't make sense for someone from St. Louis to bring their pigs over to me in north of Kansas City. You know, so if there's a slaughterhouse closer by them, they'll take it there.
Who are the closest slaughterhouses to you, though? A couple hours away?
Or? We have several houses that are within 45 minutes
okay.
of us. Yeah, there's a few. But again, you know, they have their customer base. They have maybe a different niche that what we may be doing. So again, I don't really consider it as competition. Mm. You know, as a matter of fact, I belong to MAMP, which is the Missouri Association of Meat Processors, and we have a convention every year. And believe me, when we go to the convention, it's like family. Yeah. You know, you go in and you talk about the same problems, and then all of a sudden you find out that everybody is having the same problems.
Except when it comes to the competition for who makes the best sausages.
Now, there is some competition in that, yeah.
Or severed.
Now, I was going to just mention something about HACCP. You know, you guys were talking about HACCP, and, you know, just to give you an example of what type of paperwork we do, most large slaughter facilities only have one or two HACCP plans. They only slaughter. And then, you know, on the fresh side, they'll do the fresh processing. We have like 8 different HACCP plans, so we have a very complicated system. But we have to do all these different things in order to keep our business alive and well. So, you know, 1 month of HACCP looks like a small phone book and paperwork.
Wow.
You know, and that's just 1 month. So we have file cabinets over the last, since 2003 when we opened. We have just file cabinets full of paperwork up in our attic, and it's just everywhere. And we have to keep that for, 7 years? We have to keep those files on hand for USDA for 7 years. So, yeah. And then we have to go through the analysis from USDA. They come in every so often, and they'll do a complete – they'll go through everything that we do, you know. And that's kind of tough, too. That's a tough –
Do those inspectors, and I want to ask you guys the same, the authority figures that USDA DOC, I think, is the USDA inspector who has an office in your facility, mm-hmm. and he has to have his own office and his own telephone line. And for you guys, I guess it's the grading. Who is that? That's the
Department of Health and Mental Hygiene.
Are those guys fair and smart, and is it in their interest to see you guys succeed, or the opposite?
We're due for a health inspection very soon, so I'd like to give a shout out to the DOH. I think you guys are great. You're welcome to come in anytime. Love to have you.
Some free bacon, egg, and cheese sandwiches with your name on it. What's your experience? I mean, starting these, just starting 2 restaurants in Brooklyn. I mean, are people out to help you?
I mean, the frame of mind I always try to keep is that, like, these guys have a worse job than meter readers. Like, they nobody ever wants to see them, and the minute they walk through the door to do their job, everyone starts throwing up walls and trying to get away from them. And, like, they have to be aggressive, they have to be, and they're always in a bad mood. I mean, the fire department comes in and inspects, and with them it's like, hey, what's going on? Like, we want to help you. They're explicit about saying that, like, we want to help you succeed, we want to make sure you don't burn down, we want to help you get all your things fixed. But with the health department, you know, they have a million more things to regulate, and they have they've got to keep their eyes on everything all at once. And the consequences of them not doing their job, they're going to get, you know, they're serious. You know, we can't have people dying in restaurants.
That'd be terrible.
Yeah.
Terrible.
On the other hand, I mean, the other way I think of it is, any inspector who wants to flunk you can find a way to do it. Hmm. There's
it's like an NBA ref. There's always some foul exactly. to call yeah, it. Yeah, they exactly. want to call it.
And they, if they do that the first time, you know, I don't know how the system works exactly, but you know, there's a lot of revenue to be made for the city by finding some faults the first time, which you then have to pay fines for. And on your follow-up inspection, you may then get an A and get a perfect grade, but yeah, you still have to pay the fines for that first inspection. It's
fines yeah. cost. We actually once gave Roberta's a point because of what a shit show the studio was. I was like, oh, brother, man, that it must have been really bad if they got a point for this place. But what's a fine cost? What are you paying? A couple $1,000?
Yeah, I would say I count on every inspection costing us a couple $1,000.
Really?
Yeah.
Very interesting. How about you guys? Your doc, I mean, he's not looking for trouble, right?
He's there to do a job just like, you know, the health department does. They're there to do their job. You know, it's all of our job, not just theirs, to make sure you're doing what you're, you know, it's your job to make sure you're providing safe food for your customers, period. You know, there's no leverage there. There's no...
You're like, come on, that liver is not that green.
But, you know, all in all, you know, we get along with our inspectors pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
When they come in and they do their yearly inspections, or you know, when the who was that? Who was the Dr. Tinker that came in?
Timer.
But let me ask.
The FSIS.
Yeah.
Isn't it a little bit of absurdity to it all, too? I mean, you're doing stuff in the most pristine, clean way, probably in the history of processing plants, in the history of the world. So, and yet, you know, you're going all the temperature things, and they also want to kill a lot of the tasty bacteria and all that stuff. I mean, is it absurd? I mean, what would you change?
You know, I don't know that I'd change anything. You know, because it works, and you know, we don't get yelled at, so.
Okay.
What's absurd is when they write you up because you put a wrong date on something, or you don't write the date correctly, or... You didn't sign the temperature log correctly, or you didn't do the temperature log enough, or something. That kind of stuff is.
We just lost 200 listeners. That was so detailed and boring. No, but I'm saying it's true. It's like that's how crazy that is.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, NRs. You know, anybody at any time can walk in through a plant and find NRs.
Yeah.
You know, non-compliance, and
that's, you know, NC. And,
well, yeah, but they call them NRs.
Oh, really? No wonder they're so weird. Look at them. They don't even know how to read. This thing could be a really terrible sketch. Joe, be prepared to edit this out. But I would love to go. Just headlines. We have 3 minutes left, 3.5 minutes. So start with you, a pig. Pig comes in. It's live in your pen. And I want to take it all the way through in terms of how it's cut and in the order that it's cut and all that. And I'll take over the distribution part when you put it to cannonball. So live pig, tell me the steps. I know you want to talk about each step for 20 detail. Minutes.
No, but. I can't. So, yeah, they come in. Of course, they're inspected when they come off the trailer to make sure they're all healthy and good shape.
Certified humane pens.
Certified humane pens. Well, we're not actually certified humane, but that's another
story. The process is, yeah.
Yeah. So we take them in. We put the animal down. We use electricity.
Stunner.
Yeah, stunner. It knocks the animal insensible.
Mm-hmm.
So our guy's trained to make sure that the animal's completely out before he can bleed the animal. It's very important that there's no eye movement. And so that's his job. He takes care of the pig, brings it in, stuns it, and then takes it up, and we got to have
it
bled.
Takes it up, what do you mean? It gets
on a hoist, yeah. We pick it up on a hoist.
Where do you tie it to? The shank? And
the hind shank. And then we pick it up with a hoist, and then the animal's bled. We have about 30 to 45 seconds to get that done.
Why is that time sensitive?
Because of the electrical shock, that animal could come back to life in about 45 seconds.
I see.
So it's very important that we get that done quickly.
So they're not
and efficiently.
They're not dead after.
Not
the
with
first
the electricity.
Time.
They're out. Okay. It's just like they're in, you know, they have no feelings. There's no movement.
Yeah. And they're bled via the neck?
Yes. Yes.
You have the juggler's hit a specific
cut.
Vein?
Yeah. It just reaches up, cuts the juggler, and then we dump that out into a big vat. And then the animal gets laid into a scalder immediately afterwards. And that scalder removes all the hair.
And on the rare breeds, that's a tougher process.
Yes, it is.
Their hair doesn't come off as easy.
That's correct. Some of them, well, I'll give you an example. We could probably do 45 Berkshires in a half a day, where we can only do maybe 30 to 35 Duroc's just because of the hard hair.
So red hair. Pigs are tough.
Yeah, they are.
Red wattle, Duroc.
So once the animal comes out of the scalder, we have a couple guys that finish off with a knife with all the hair. Mm-hmm. And then it goes to the evisceration. All the guts and everything get dumped out on a table, and our inspector goes through every part of the pig.
Is that a good telltale sign if the animal was unhealthy, those organs?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he'll be able to tell. Especially in the liver, you know, and then the glands in the jowls, they'll open those up and look at those.
How many pigs get stopped at that point? I mean, next to none, ever, right?
Hardly any. You know, yeah. If there's an animal that's in question, then we have to tag it and put it on a separate rail, and we'll leave it in the cooler with the tag around it until a veterinarian shows up, and then he'll inspect it and he'll either condemn the animal or let it go on through process.
So I interrupted you. So he's looking at the organs, he okays it?
Yes, he okays the animal, and then once that happens, then any trimming and washing is done. The animal split, weighed, and then put into a cooler. That cooler runs about 33 degrees normally, but it's designed to take about 14,000 pounds of hot meat that's probably, you know, 100, 104 degrees down to 40 degrees in about 16 hours.
Why is that important? That
it's important for the pH in the animal. And I can't get into the pH part of it, but it's important that the animals cool down quickly, get the heat out of it, because a lot of times we're going to process the next day, so the animal has to be ready to be processed, and we want it chilled below that 40 degrees.
Then you cut it and you ship it?
Yes, it all goes through the slaughter or through the cutting room. All the pigs get moved. We do the slaughter on Mondays, Tuesdays. We cut up Wednesdays, Thursdays. And then Thursday evening, we have Cannonball there picking up pallets.
Shipping all those pigs to the Jewish capital of the world, Manhattan. I'm a Jew, so I can say that. And so I'm the only Jewish pig merchant for rare breeds, I think. So I get it. It comes to Pat LaFrieda, who does not touch it. You know, he just shepherds it on, which is an unbelievably lucky relationship we have, because we can deliver to 80 restaurants, and we deliver to Parish Hall. You get this pig. You also get a lot of the pigs from upstate New York, but, you know, whenever that's not going or there's a storm, you bring in that pig. What happens?
We bring in that pig. We usually get a side at a time. We do that every week instead of getting a whole pig every 2 weeks just to keep it fresh. We also get a box of organs, and we get a head. The first thing that happens is we take the head and we set it on to boil, because we make a head cheese out of it that we end up using for dinner. So we'll cut off the ears to save for a separate use, and we'll usually cut off either one or both of the jowls. Usually there's a jowl still on the body of the pig as well, so end up with three. We'll take either one or two of those and cure them for a jowl bacon, and then the rest will go in and be boiled and eventually picked for the torchon of the head meat. The organs we've been using a lot recently to make scrapple at Egg. We were buying scrapple for a while, but this is kind of, you know, one of the like traditional ingenious ways of using every last bit of the animal. Is you just take all this stuff that you wouldn't use for anything else, you toss it into this patty essentially, and make a delicious, you know, delicious breakfast meat. So that's, you know, one of the ways we put all those things to use. And then with the pig, we'll take it and we'll break it down.
Same order always, break it down and serve it at the restaurant over the course of the week?
Not always the exact same order, but it follows a pretty reliable pattern. We'll take, when we break it down, we take off the ham, and then we remove the shoulder, we take off the belly and debone the whole loin. We'll either cure and hang the ham, or put it into some sort of brine for a cooked ham, if we don't have a use for it in that way, we'll debone it and use that meat for sausage. We'll use the shoulders either to braise or for a sausage of some sort. We'll cook the loin as part of a pork dish, and we'll cure the belly for bacon. And then we'll save up shanks and trotters and ears and tails over time. And once we have a number of those accrued, we can, you know, turn them into some sort of special that can last more than one or two orders at a time. So we're able to go through it with you know, some consistency and efficiency, I think, at the restaurant. You know, not in the scale or speed that would probably happen in a slaughterhouse, but I think in a way that helps us really understand what we're using and draws a lot of thoughtfulness out of us.
Well, and then just for our newborn listeners, then it's consumed, eaten, goes into the water supply, becomes rain, fertilizes the fields, feeds the pigs again. So anyway, that's just for the people who've never eaten before. So that is full circle. And this has been a very interesting show. I mean, I kind of feel we could have gone on 2 hours easy. I mean, you guys didn't even talk, but hopefully you guys will stay for a pizza and talk to them a little bit off air. But remember, Heritage Radio Network is an archive, so you can search Half Pig or, you know, Red Pigs or Hasset Plan, and this show will come up. Can you guys give us your website?
Yeah, parishhall.net.
Parishhall.net.
Eggrestaurant.com is our other
Eggrestaurant.com and...
ParadiseMeats.com and PhantasmasFinest.com.
And HeritageFoodsUSA.com. Those are the three, the triangle of websites. Well, thank you guys so much for coming in on a Sunday.
Yeah, this was great.
Thanks.
Yeah, and I really want you guys to come in again. And, of course, anytime you guys are in town, you're always welcome. So thanks for 10 years of collaboration. By the way, they're celebrating their 10-year anniversary this September. So that's going to be a big event.
Where's that?
Thank you.
We're engineered and produced by Joe Galarraga and sponsored by Whole Foods. Stay tuned for Straight No Chaser. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.